shooter's apparent change of heart. Police say after shooting a 6-year-old girl, Smith put her in the hands of a neighbor. The girl, believed to be Cassidy Ralston, is in a Springfield hospital. After the slaying, Smith fled in a white Chevy Lumina. Kilby couldn't say where he went or what he did the next several hours, only that just before 7:30, police spotted him about 7 miles outside of Manchester. After a high-speed chase, he shot at them. They shot back. Smith was wounded, and shortly after 10 a.m., the suspect was dead. Colby wouldn't give any possible motive or connection other than to say,
"We know there was an acquaintance between the victims and the shooters. We're still exploring that relationship."
But in a small village like Manchester, rumors and possibilities are running rampant. Nearly everyone knows either Smith or the people he shot. Julie Hardwick lived next door to them, one apartment over in the Scott County Public Housing Complex.
"The little kids, they're lovable. I mean, you couldn't ask for a little better kids. They was just, I enjoyed having them around because I live by myself. And I just don't know what I'd do if it was my grandkid."
Hardwick works as a dishwasher at a cafe in a neighboring town, Whitehall. Manchester itself has no restaurants, no shops to speak of, just the park with its playground, two churches alongside it, and the connected village hall and post office. Less than 300 people live there. Ron Drake is the village president.
"I was appointed to a position in 2002 when our previous village president passed away, and I can't get out of the job."
He's also Rick Smith's uncle. The two weren't close.
"Not that close. Like I said, it's been 2 years since I talked to him last time."
"When was that? What was that for?"
He wanted to borrow a tool.
Still, Drake, who says Smith is his wife's sister's son, says he was devastated when he learned his unemployed nephew was the suspected shooter. He says Smith's family had no warning, no idea. They didn't notice any signs. Authorities say Smith's previous criminal record includes a conviction for reckless homicide related to a DUI and a sundry of charges for drugs and writing fake checks.
"And we're just going to have to ask the Lord to help us and press on."
"In my opinion, Boston Massacre is about the same as this."
Glenna Pruitt's one of several Manchester residents I met who says she's praying not only for the victims and their relatives, but also for the shooters.
"When you have a small community where people live their entire life versus in a city, everyone knows everyone. So it's not going to just affect one person or one family. It's going to affect this entire community."
Something like this happening in small town America, says Rodney Havens, shows nobody's immune from these things. Havens has lived in Manchester since he was a kid. He's now raising his own children there. The murders have left him asking the same questions people anywhere and everywhere ask after a tragedy.
"What do you say? You know, what do you offer up to the families that had to go through this? You know, I think everybody's probably more in shock. How did it happen? Why did it happen here?"
Questions that, no matter what unfolds, police's ongoing investigation won't be able to definitively answer. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. The National Transportation Safety Board has completed 2 days of hearings on the problems affecting Boeing's fleet of 787 Dreamliners. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports on the final day of the hearing for the Chicago-based company.
The worldwide fleet of Boeing 787s that's been grounded for 3 months will soon be returning to passenger service. Those jets will have newly designed batteries housed in a fireproof containment box. There are other safety enhancements, too. And one can't help but wonder if some of those features should have been incorporated into Boeing's earlier design of the battery. But it's not that simple. As NTSB Chairman Deborah Hersman noted, the battery failure on the JAL jet and a second serious battery failure that same month came as a surprise.
"Those events were not expected by the operators, by Boeing. They were not expected or anticipated by the regulator."
Boeing never conducted a test that produced the kinds of failures that occurred on those two jets. And that leads Hersman to conclude,
"We do know that those test conditions weren't conservative enough."
Boeing made assumptions about how the battery would behave that don't seem to hold up. But those assumptions drove some of the testing that Boeing did. In approving the batteries, the FAA relied in large part on Boeing's own data and test results. The agency doesn't have the resources to do their own comprehensive analysis. Still, FAA officials like Steve Boyd insist the agency's fundamental approach to airplane safety is sound.
We try to build whole families of requirements that trap the safety issues.
The one thing we cannot do, he said, is wait until we know everything about a new technology before we adopt it. Hirschman wouldn't quarrel with that, but suggested that the FAA should have required that Boeing retest its battery using industry standards that came out after regulators had approved the 787 testing requirements. But Boyd told Hirschman those tests weren't required then and shouldn't be required now.
That typically would be done only if we identified an unsafe condition.
Have you identified any unsafe conditions where you would want to modify the expectations for lithium-ion battery performance?
His answer was no. That exchange goes to a central question for the NTSB. Are FAA standards and its certification process flexible enough to adapt to new information and changing technologies? Ensuring flexibility will likely be one of the recommendations that stem from this investigation. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine here on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube, and this is the fourth weekday of our Spring Pledge Drive. We're wrapping it up on Saturday or sooner if we raise $120,000 before the end of the drive. So the faster that you donate, the faster we can wrap up our campaign. Give us a call at 217-244-9455 or pledge online at willpledge.org. Thank you to a few more people who've called in this hour with your donations. Janann Feeney in Savoy. Thank you very much, Janann. And Meka Van Act, who called in with a very generous pledge from Monticello. Thank you, Meka. And thank you to everybody who has called in so far to contribute. We have had just an incredible outpouring from all sorts of communities across the state, across Illinois, across Indiana. We've had people calling in from Iowa and Wisconsin as well. That really is making the difference right now and pushing us towards our goal of 120,000. Right now we're at 83,779. So that's good, but we still have a ways to go. So if you're a new listener to WYLL, if you're someone who's just found out about public radio recently, maybe you were flipping the dial and heard some of NPR's coverage of the election, or you heard some of the BBC's World Services coverage of Syria, then please make that known. The reason that public radio was there for you to discover it is because of generations of people before you who donated to keep it strong and to keep it on the air. This year, WYLL is 90 years old. And the reason it's been able to stay operational for so long, serving this community for so long, is because our listeners have contributed. They've stepped up to the plate. So make sure that public radio will be there for the next generation of listeners as well. Pay it forward and do the favor that someone has already done for you. Give us a call at 217-244-9455 or pledge online at willpledge.org. And if you haven't already seen some of the gifts that you can receive for donating, $52 or more, you get the Will member card, which gets discounts to hundreds of restaurants across the state, including restaurants in Chicagoland and Champaign-Urbana and all over Illinois. And you also get discounts for all sorts of online retailers like Best Buy, Kohl's, all the big names. Go to willpledge.org to find out more about the member card and about our drive and the other great premiums that we have. You could get travel mugs that are branded to All Things Considered or Morning Edition. You can get the Public Radio temporary tattoos that we talked about this morning on Morning Edition. Those are great. There's a really good one of two snakes fighting. That one's for On the Media. That's to represent for Gladstone and Bob Garfield, the host of that show. So willpledge.org to find out more about the premiums. And give us a call with your pledge now, 217-244-9455. Make your voice heard and remind us of how much you care about WYLL.
WILL programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2013 lecture series presents Reinvigorating Kensington Palace, Creating a Palace for Everyone, by Michael Day, on Thursday, April 25th at 4 p.m. at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 25th of April, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet Ted Kooser, born Ames, Iowa, 1939, who said, "I had a wonderfully happy childhood." He started writing poetry seriously as a teenager. He said, "I was desperately interested in being interesting. Poetry seemed a way of being different." Went to college, flunked out of grad school, took the first job he was offered at a life insurance company, worked there for 35 years.
Ted Kuser says, I believe that writers write for perceived communities. I worked every day with people who didn't read poetry, who hadn't read it since they were in high school, and I wanted to write for them. So, every morning he got up at 4:30, made a pot of coffee, wrote until 7, then he put on his suit and his tie, and he went to work. It's the birthday of Howard R. Garris, born in Binghamton, New York, 1873, who gave us Uncle Wiggily, the old rabbit in the suit and the top hat. Garris was a reporter for the Newark Evening News. He wrote hundreds of children's books, published his first Uncle Wiggily story in a newspaper in 1910. It was so popular, he ended up writing an Uncle Wiggily story 6 days a week for more than 30 years. Howard R. Garris said, half the fun of nearly everything is thinking about it beforehand or afterward. It's the birthday of Ella Fitzgerald, Newport News, Virginia, 1917. When she was 16, she entered a contest at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, walked on stage wearing ragged clothes, men's boots. She sang "The Object of My Affection," won the contest. Soon she was fully employed in the nightclubs of New York. And it's the birthday of Paget Powell, born Gainesville, Florida, 1952. Went to college, studied chemistry, spent 8 years as a roofer in Texas, working on a novel on the side. Here's a poem for today by Sharon Olds, Crazy. I've said that he and I had been crazy for each other, but maybe my ex and I were not crazy for each other. Maybe we were sane for each other, as if our desire was almost not even personal. It was personal, but that hardly mattered, since there seemed to be no other woman or man in the world. Maybe it was an arranged marriage. Air and water and earth had planned us for each other, and fire, a fire of pleasure, like a violence of kindness, to enter those vaults together, like a solemn or laughing couple in formal step or writhing hair and cry, seemed to me like the earth's and moon's paths, inevitable and even in a way shy, enclosed in a shyness, together, equal in it. But maybe I was crazy about him. It is true that I saw that light around his head when I'd arrived second at a restaurant. Oh, for God's sake, I was besotted with him. Meanwhile, the planets orbited each other, the morning and the evening came, and maybe what he had